were talking about the control of the book.
Yes.
Yes, it was very necessary to know exactly what your commitments were. Mm. And as I say, in my father's case, he didn't want to borrow too much money from the bank. And if at the end of the account, which had normally happened, because people used to come in sellers at the end of the account, and you could take advantage of this because you, as I was saying earlier, one could read how a broker's mind was working. He'd bought the stock at the beginning of the account, it hadn't gone up, so he wanted to sell it. Or even if it had gone up, he still wanted to sell it because he didn't want to pay for the shares, you know, over the fortnightly account. So obviously at times one could do a good deal like that, and it was in your own interests to take stock on board at the end. In fact, there was a lot of kind of that they would do cash and new deals, sell them for cash and buy them for new time, which you could also charge them quite a bit for, because it would mean that, of course, that the jobber was paying for the stock. So,
did Smiths have a distinctive approach to jobbing, or did you find?
Yes, they were forceful jobbers. They wanted to run the market themselves. Maybe this sounds slightly over the top, but they were aggressive, and they wanted to be a formidable force in the market, which they undoubtedly were. And they expected you to do the same, really.
How did you find that?
Well, it was okay as far as I was concerned, because if one knows a market well, one feels fairly confident. I think it's a matter of confidence, really, in yourself, knowing what you're doing, than, not having a vague idea whether you've done a good bargain or a bad bargain. Obviously, you make mistakes, you have to take them as they come. So being aggressive, there are ways of being aggressive. One can do it in a pleasant way, one can do it in an unpleasant way. So,
is it possible to elaborate a little bit on that?
What, being pleasant or unpleasant?
Yes, or how one...
One can do it in a charming sort of way without getting the broker upset.
Yes.
And,
for
example,
yes.
If you've made a broker a price and he comes back and he finds he can't get a better price elsewhere, you can change your price and say, "I'm sorry, and I've seen something else. I've changed my price." You will suspect what he's doing, because especially as you know probably what the other jobber's making anyway. And normally speaking, with an unaggressive jobber, he would... He might not change his price. He'd probably say, "Yes, all right, well, what do you want to do then?" But you can be hard, and you can be unpleasant about it and say, "No, I've seen you go around the market. I'm not going to be on to you. Change the price." But you can do it in such a way that he can't really take offence about it. It's just a matter of the way you tackle the problem, I think, really. Easy ways to do these things. I've always found that I've had a lot of friends amongst brokers, and it's just a question of knowing them and explaining why you've changed your price and so forth. It's just like that, really.
You mentioned earlier in the early 60s that the influence of the unit trusts and the investment institutions in giving a fillip to the rubber market.
Yes.
Were there other ways in which you noticed that the influence of the institutions? Did you find you were dealing in larger size?
Oh, much larger. Before, it was fairly small. the size of the market increased tremendously in the 60s. I would say you were quite prepared then to make prices in 25, 50, 100,000. And also the East were buying the shares too. There were big orders coming from Kuala Lumpur or Singapore, and you used to offer them stock overnight, and they used to take it, and a tremendous amount number of shares in the specialized stocks which they were interested in. Went over there, and they built up very big holdings, and this is why, you see, they wanted all these English estates. They didn't really want to nationalize them as they did in Sri Lanka, but they wanted to buy them fairly. And they were quite prepared to pay high prices in order to hand them over to the Malays and people like that, and the Chinese who ran the estates. And I thought that they did it extremely fairly. They were happy to buy them at advanced prices. And then, you know, when they got 28-29%, they were then prepared to make a bid for them. Mm. And if you look at the situation now, you can tell that they now do own practically every rubber estate, because they've done it in a reasonable way.
How did that affect liquidity? Didn't it mean that more and more shares were being tightly held?
Yeah, well, to start with, you see, it meant that there was a tremendous market in them. And then as more and more shares went over to the East and went into the institutions' hands, the market began to close up again, you see. So you had to be very careful, you know, whether you made a price in a large number of shares or not, because in spite of the fact that some of these stocks, like Highlands and Lowlands and Golden Hope and Kuala Lumpur Kepong, you felt that all the shares must be over there, then all of a sudden you discovered a seller of about 100,000 or something like that. And it still goes on today. There are still shares over here which one's overlooked, and one doesn't go through the share registers to check up on who owns the shares, but periodically you do get big orders over here, but normally speaking, there's hardly anybody now who owns any rubber shares in this country, except for one or two institutions.
Did you find you were still able to turn your book over fairly rapidly, or were you taking positions that you were carrying?
Well, one probably took positions because one wanted to. After all, jobbing in those days was not was a question of taking positions. These days, it's still the same, you know, with our firm, but it isn't with other firms who have been taken over by other bodies, and they've been told to run level books. You see, it seems to me that the SIB and all these FIMRA, all these are slightly against the jobbers. They want to. They want the market to behave more like New York, I think, like Wall Street. They don't want jobbers to take positions. One kind of gets this impression. Whereas, obviously, if you don't take a position, if you don't take a risk, you're not going to make any money. And they're destroying, you know, the jobbing system, like because of this.
Yes. Had position taking always been an element in your firm's jobbing right back from the beginning?
Yes, one never wanted to be level. Mm. One would say that you couldn't make a price if you were level.
Was that distinctive to the rubber market or?
No, to the whole jobbing. The whole stock exchange, yes. Mm. You had to have a position, otherwise you couldn't make a price, but that is. Unless, you know, you could make a very close price if you hadn't got a position, because you wouldn't, maybe you didn't mind which way you went. But it's not really quite the case now. A lot of people don't want to take any risks. They don't really want to be market makers. They want to just get the commission on the brokerage deals which they're putting through.
How had your career unfolded with Smith Brothers? Did you stay on the rubber book now right until you
Yes,
retired?
I did. Well, as I knew so much about it, you know, they obviously thought it would be better to them for me to stay on it. Mm. Mm. And after all, as I say, there was a lot of money made on it, so that was obviously the main point.
Let me ask you a few more detailed questions about perhaps jobbing in the latter part of your career. You mentioned earlier that by now there was only one other firm dealing in rubber stocks, Pynchon.
Yes.
Did you feel it was still a competitive market? Did the brokers feel that they could get a competitive price?
Yes, because we were both fairly aggressive dealers. So consequently, they did get a good deal, although they didn't particularly like the people who dealt in Pynchon. So we did have a bit of an edge on it. The chap who ran the rubber book there was not a particularly pleasant individual, and you know, we always got first choice practically, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't any competition. There was a big competition because he was aggressive as well, so I would say that the public didn't do too badly out of it. But now, of course, Pynchon have gone. Morgan Grenfell, who took them over, you know, packed up dealing. So there is only one jobber in rubber shares now. But there again, it's unlikely that anybody else would want to come into the market because there's hardly any market. You know, all the shares, as I've said, have been sent out to the east or... you know, they're now owned by Malays.
Did you ever feel there was a market outside of the stock exchange in the sense that institutions were dealing directly with each other or they might have been going to an outside broking house or an outside merchant bank?
Well, they weren't really allowed to do that. Mm. They had to do their deals through the stock exchange. Mm.
This is the clients rather than the brokers.
The clients, yes. The stock had to be put through, even if it was only for a minute amount. So, if you did the put through and you knew the price, you were always in a position to say that you didn't agree with that price. If the price was below the market price. If, for example, the shares were standing around about £1 and they wanted to put through stock at 95 and 95 and an eighth, you would say, no, that's far too low. I'm quite prepared to bid 97 for the stock. So you might get it then. And this was how you could keep tabs on what was going on. You could see the marks in the paper the next day. You went through the marks with a fine tooth comb to know exactly what you'd missed and so forth. So you could always kind of keep a finger on what was going on.
Were you doing much put through business?
Oh yeah, there was quite a lot of put through business, yes, because certain stocks, you know, were popular, and there were lots of institutions who had extremely good profits. And sometimes they wanted to transfer them from one fund to another and things like that, you see.
They
wanted to know the right price, and only the only way to find the right price was to test the market.
Did you ever feel that you were being deprived of business in the sense that so much matching was going on that you...
But you could always object to it. Mm.
And that was something you didn't ever have any qualms about?
No, none whatsoever. If you wanted the stock and if you thought that it was the wrong price which they were putting it through at, well, then you would say so. Mm. And they would say, all right, well, if that's the wrong price, you better stuff in with the shares.
And would you take stock on even if a broker had come up to do a put through, even if you didn't have a buyer or a seller in mind?
If you think that they look cheap, yes. You might, as you say, you might not have any limits, but you've got a pretty good feeling about the share. You wouldn't take an unnecessary risk, although sometimes, of course, it didn't come off, and you were stuck with them. Well, it's rather like those stocks, the shares with Ferranti, with Smith Brothers. We took the stock. Look where it landed us.
One of the reasons I asked you about business going on between institutions or outside of the stock exchange was because I believe that with a lot of international stocks, as the 70s progressed, gold stocks, for example, that a lot of the business was being done outside of the stock exchange. But this was not something that you've...
Well, I think it might have been in foreign stocks, in South Africans, of course. But where the market was in London, and where most of the shares were held by the shops themselves, like, you know, I'm talking about the rubber market, there were, you know, Harrison Crossfield, Barlow, R.P. Evans, lots of shares which were controlled over here, they were more than happy to put them through the market, because that was the, if it was a London-based stock, you had to do that. You couldn't, maybe it might have been done without one knowing it, but those were the rules.
Did you ever have any contact with the companies in whose stocks you were trading? You know, either with the directors or at general meetings? Or?
Yes, we knew one or two of them, yes. I think, you know, it was rather necessary to know these people, especially, you know, if you could go on to them and say, you know, what you had in mind. It could have been frowned upon, but you've got to know about the stocks which you deal in, and not that you're asking for any inside information or anything like that. I'm saying all you can do is to go on and say, well, look, I've got a cheap line of X which you might be interested in, and I've come on to you direct. And he'd say, well, I'll have a think about it and, you know, let you know through my broker. And he would deal through his broker, you see, let me know who it was. And that wasn't really frowned upon. Although maybe the broker was rather upset that you hadn't gone to him straight away, but you did meet a lot of people who were associated with companies, and you know, that's that's how it was done.
Did the brokers ever use you as a source of information on the stocks of the different
companies? Well, they're asking
companies.
Questions about who the seller was or things like that. Yes, but they're not really supposed to do that. You say you couldn't tell them. One had to be rather limited as regards, you know, what you said.
And what about...
Because otherwise they'd have probably gone on to them straight away themselves, something like that.
And what about generally people wanting to know about, you know, the figures of a particular company or whatever? Did you ever find that you were a source
way
of
out.
Information in that sense?
Yes, they asked your opinion about what the figures were going to be, and you really actually got this information from the broker who was, you know, the shop. Because I don't think a jobber is all that good at working out a firm's profits. I'm saying he's there to buy and sell. He's not there to give a forecast. But there again, when the figures do come out, within about 30 seconds, you've got to make a price. So you've got to have a fairly good idea about whether the figures are good or bad. And if you've got a bad you know, a reputation for always being wrong. It's best to just shut up and make a wide prize. Mm.
Did capital continue to be something that you're very aware of? Or with Smith Brothers, did you always have or feel that you had enough capital?
Oh, we always had enough. There wasn't any query about that. Mm. I think if your figures were good enough, you know, your own personal figures were good enough on the profits which you were making, they would. I was never asked to cut the book or do anything because, you know, they were always quite happy with what was going on. It sounds rather big-headed, but, you know, it's it does depend very much on whether you're making money or whether you're not. So, but one always had to, you know, keep a lookout on not to overstep the mark. Because, as I said, in the 70s, of course, you were dealing in far larger numbers of shares than you were in the 60s. And then as the 80s came up, of course, the numbers reduced again. Mm-hmm. But there again, I think the rubber book is now over 1 million, whereas back in those days it was about 60,000, so it has increased. They've taken up other stocks because, of course, usually there's not really very much to deal in now in rubber shares.
Now, when did you actually retire from jobbing?
This was, let's see now, it must have been 87, February 87.
So you sort of saw Big Bang and continued trading right through it.
Yeah.
Taking your career up to October 1986, did you find that jobbing itself had changed terribly much over the, what must be about 40-year span of your career?
No, it hadn't. It hadn't changed all that noticeably. The same techniques, the same way of jobbing, the same way you taught people, remained more or less exactly the same. It's only when the screens came in that, and it really ceased to become jobbing anymore, because the prices changed so radically, as you could see in October 88 when we had Black Monday. Everything snowballed because nobody wanted to buy any stock. So each time one person changed the price, so did the other jobber, until it was just snowballing down. Nobody was dealing because they didn't want to buy any stock. Whereas in the old days, you couldn't have done that because you wouldn't have known what the other people were calling shares, and you would have been stuffed anyway. So, you know, this is where this particular system, today's system, rather falls down. You haven't got anybody there prepared to take a risk, prepared to take stock, because everybody knows what everybody else is doing. I'm saying, in the reporting of bargains, in 3 minutes or so, it's nobody's going to buy 1 million shares, are they, on a falling market? Unless they have a good chance of being able to get rid of them. Because that's, you know, this is the market has grown to such an enormous extent that on the screens these days you have prices up in large, which is 100,000 or 250,000, and it's a big risk, especially if you're going to be found out.
How had the stock exchange as an institution changed over the 40 years in which you had known it? You mentioned earlier there had been a lot of older gentlemen around. It was more like a club, that there was a lot of fun.
That went, I suppose, with the new stock exchange in 1972 when the new stock exchange was built. All that idea of bonhomie and so forth disappeared with the new stock exchange. It was people obviously realised that business came first, and there was much more business anyway. Mm. Well, there were slumps, as you know. In 1974, there was a that was a bad time.
What are your memories of that particular slump? Because quite a few of the people I've interviewed have referred to it as being a difficult time.
Well, of course, the index went down to about under 150. And it went on for quite a few months.
And it affected the rubber market just as much as it affected...
I wouldn't say quite so much. We didn't really lose much money. Things came down, but one had prepared. One could see in that there was going to be trouble. So one sold short, and one was able to put the bears against the bulls and not really lose too much. But of course, the amount of business just dried up. And I think everybody felt, the calamity of the whole thing. Lots of people were sacked, and but there again, of course, the colossal expenses which are running at the moment weren't there then. You could run the firm on a fairly small figure. It's impossible now. So.
Did you ever have any feelings at the time that the market wouldn't turn?
The stock exchange always had these cycles. You know, it's this present cycle has been going on for a time. Lots of firms have fallen by the wayside. Back in 1980, firms fell by the wayside. In 74 as well. Back in 65, there's always, bad times. People always think that the stock exchange must do well, but they don't. You know, it's a profession where, there are lots of sad cases. Of course, you've only got to know something about the Stock Exchange Benevolence Society and see all those people who were quite influential figures at one time who've had to, ask for help from the Stock Exchange Benevolence Society, and it's all very sad.
Do you feel jobbing had been a riskier profession to follow than some of the others, whether in the Stock Exchange, like broking, or outside, like law or accountancy or something like that?
Riskier.
Yes, thinking again over
your
own career.
I think it's one of the riskiest things to do, because you're really rather living on your wits most of the time. I don't think I'd pick it again, quite honestly. It's you do get yourself very keyed up. You've got to have the right sort of temperament for it. And of course it can mean long hours. And there again, of course, it can mean short hours, depending naturally on whether there's, the amount of business. But it's a very exciting profession. I must say I have enjoyed it very much, especially over the last, 20 years or so. It's really been most exciting. I wouldn't miss that for anything. But I wouldn't want my son to go into it. Mm. Too uncertain.
Let me just go off on a slight tangent. It's probably a question I should have asked you earlier. But one thing that the people I interview occasionally refer to, particularly about the earlier periods of their career in the stock exchange, was trading on personal account. And I'm just curious to know how common that was among jobbers, or whether it's something that
well, I never
fell
did
out
it
of
myself.
Fashion.
I might have done it once or twice.
Yes.
But I think one so influenced by working on the stock exchange, on the individual movements of the shares which you might be interested in, that you that you won't be able to concentrate on the matter in hand. This is, I'm talking from a jobber's point of view, not from a broker, because a broker does it all the time. But from a jobber's point of view, to my way of thinking, you know, it's just not on. You can't, this is only personal. I know a lot of people that do it, but, you know, it's, I haven't myself.
What was your impression that only a few people would trade on personal account, or was it...?
No, a lot of brokers do. Because brokers obviously are seeing what their clients are doing. Yes. A jobber doesn't see. He's got to rely on a broker friend to tell him that so-and-so is buying a lot of X, feel you ought to have some.
So a jobber would... There would have been fewer jobbers. That's
well, to my way of thinking, there would have been fewer jobbers. Yes. Because they wouldn't have the information. Mm. After all, they would